My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the primary purpose group in Coweta County, and my sobriety date is November 19th, 1998. And for that, I'm truly grateful. And I rode down with Ben, a gentleman I sponsor here today, and we went over to the big house, the Allman Brothers Museum. I have to put a plug in for it. You ought to go over there if you're going to be here all weekend. It's awesome. And it was just fantastic. And I got just a taste of what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what life was kind of like in the early years. There was a thing up on the top of a poster, and it said, "Where It All Began," and it was one of their albums. Is that better? And where it all began for me was right across the river. I mean, right directly across the river. And there was a little clinic called the Riverside Clinic on Riverside Drive, right there by Central Office. And my uncle was a doctor. I think that's why all my siblings were born there, because he would deliver us for free. But I was born there at the Riverside Clinic, and my mother said I came at 2:30 in the morning, backwards, and storming out, breech berth, and I've had a pain in the butt ever since. But before I get started, I would like to thank the committee, and to thank Mike for being a wonderful host, and I would convey to him some of these stories, and the last time he was like, yeah. I was like, he wasn't very interested in that, and I realized I told him the same story four times. But Nelson Crenshaw, or C back there, invited me. So if I bomb, see that guy right back there with the glasses. And his son, Nelson III, is here too. And so there he is, right over there. And so, good to see you, Nelson. His story is a lot like mine, and probably shouldn't have blown his anonymity like that. But I'd like to thank the committee, and what a wonderful thing this is. And my heart is near and dear to Macon, Georgia. My father and my father's side of the family is all from Macon, and Crawford County, Bibb County, right in that area. And so I spent a lot of my time in my youth here in Macon, and just right there in Baconsfield or North Avenue, like Mike said, and walked those streets sober. And my story is that I began drinking alcohol at an early age, and going over to that museum really hit home for me. I mean, sometimes I think we stay sober a while and we forget where we come from, and I have to remember where I come from. Recently, I had a friend die, and I told my sister-in-law, "I'm not going to go to that funeral. There'll be a lot of derelicts there, and I don't feel like putting up with that." And she said, "Is that right? And you used to be the head derelict. And those, you need to go to that funeral, because you might be the only big book they ever see." And I thought to myself, how could I think like that? But it's because I've been transformed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm truly grateful for that. I got some good news. You know, this thing works, and I want to talk about that. And I want to talk about the power of God working in my life. And God loves me so much. I mean, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Alcoholics Anonymous is the absolute best thing that's ever happened to me, and I have a passionate love affair with it. Like I said, I grew up born here, and then we moved around a lot. My mother and father were in the aviation business. My mother was a stewardess for Eastern Airlines, and that's where she met my father. And I said I probably was the derivative from the Mile High Club, but once I was born, Warren, my father, quit the airlines, and he actually I think he jinxed me on my birth certificate. He was a captain for Eastern Airlines, and it says father's occupation, used car dealer. Because he and my uncle had a little used car lot over on Broadway, and my two older brothers would talk about how they sold cars and they would finance them, and James Brown and Little Richard and people like that would all come in and buy cars, because this was a music town back then. My Aunt Polly used to say that those Allman Brothers are Satan worshipers, and my grandmother said no, they weren't. They just played music Sunday morning when they were trying to have church over there. So if you had long hair, you would worship Satan. But my grandmother had little Otis, worked and, you know, rake leaves for her, and then he grew up to be Otis Redding, and they would talk about that was little Otis. And my grandmother, till the day she died, still never believed that little Otis was actually Otis Redding, but it was. I came from a good family, you know. I did have some alcoholism in my genes, so to speak. I've said this before, I'm every ethnic group that probably should not drink alcohol. I'm Scotch, Irish, with some Italian in there, and then a lot of American Indian from over in the Upson County area. Every ethnic group that should not drink, all rolled into one. And so what happened for me is at an early age, the lure of alcohol had me before I even took a drink. And I don't know what that was about, except for, well, that museum over there showed. I mean, the music, it was the late 60s, the early 70s. I just loved all that, and the older people in my family, my cousins, and they were all just doing what everybody was doing back then. And so as a child, my mother showed me a t-shirt. I'm 9 and I have a Budweiser t-shirt on. You know, I mean, we go to the fair and try to win those little Jack Daniels mirrors and things like that. And I never drank, but I saw it working in everybody else's lives around me. And my folks, we lived in Florida after moving from here, and they did a lot of entertaining, and my daddy never drank because his father was an alcoholic, but did a lot of entertaining, a lot of drinking, and I'd see what the families were, you know, the parents were all, they were all stressed out over money and relationships and all the work and everything. But what they would do is they, in the evening time, they'd start drinking, especially on the weekends. They'd roll the record player out there by the, we had a pool, so everybody come to our house, and they'd crank up the Grand Funk or whatever it was, Johnny Cash, and they'd start drinking, and it made everything okay. It made everything okay. And as a child, I saw that. What I saw was alcohol is a solution. It's not a problem. I mean, they get drunk every now and then and cut a rusty, but for the most part, it was a solution, not a problem. And they'd get drunk and start pushing each other in the swimming pool, and then about midnight they'd be skinny dipping, and we're kids, we'd be in there looking through the, and it was like, almost I couldn't wait to drink. And what happened for me is when I picked up a drink, alcohol brought out the alcoholic in me immediately. It was like putting gasoline on a fire, just boom. And another friend of mine and I stole a case of beer, and we even gave 12 away, so we had 12 Miller High Life beers. And he and I took those 12 beers and iced them down the best we could to get drunk and have fun, whatever that meant. I was like 14 years old, and it was the summertime, no responsibilities, and we put them in the sink and iced them down. And we didn't say to each other, listen, you drink them as fast as you can, because that's what I'm going to do. But he drank one or two, and I drank 10 or 11. And I took those beers, and I drank them down as fast as I could, like Miller Brewing Company was never going to brew anymore. And I woke up in a sand trap at a golf course with vomit in my hair and sand, a black eye, my shirt ripped, missing a shoe. At 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I came to in that sand trap, and I thought to myself, man, that was awesome. I mean, I didn't remember anything that happened. The last recollection I had, I was on a sidewalk and the whole world was spinning around, and I came to in that sand trap, and I could not wait to do it again. And it was, the first time I drank, I got in trouble. You know, how much trouble do you get in when you're a kid? And, you know, we were, the kid we gave the beer to threw up on his mom, you know. It wasn't even me, you know. It was so bad. But we had to march over there and tell the pro at the golf shop that we stole the beer or whatever. But I got in trouble. And that set a pattern for me too. Not that every time I drank I got in trouble, but every time I got in trouble, I had been drinking. And it was like the very next day, maybe the day after, another kid's got a case of Black Label beer. And we're going up to the tree fort in the woods to just drink it as fast as we can. And that just started a pattern for me. And the pattern was, I came from a good family. There's no reason I should have been an alcoholic, a teenage alcoholic. And my older brothers and sister and cousins and stuff, they went through that phase. Then they got their head on straight, went to college, became professional people. I just went to jail. I mean, I just drank until I got locked down, and it was not pretty. It was usually a big mess. And it set a pattern for me until November 18th, 1998. I would drink and drink and drink and drink and drink. Bam! Something would blow up in my face. I'd get locked down, and it'd be city jail, an emergency room, treatment, a detox, or whatever it might be. And I physically could not get the alcohol, so I wouldn't drink. But I was a pretty good old boy sober, so I'd tell them what they want to hear. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Oh, no, sir. I'd never. And they'd turn me loose. And the first thing I'd do, I mean, I had no intention whatsoever of being sober. And I got in big trouble fast. I mean, I was a pretty good kid, like I said. I got good grades in school. I didn't have to try real hard. Had a little girlfriend, played baseball, football. When I started drinking, my girlfriend dumped me because I was drunk. I went from A's and B's to D's and F's and got thrown off the football team, quit the base. I mean, and everything in my life changed. And I didn't care. I mean, because it made time for more drinking. And that's all I wanted. And I look back on that. That's crazy. But that's what I did. And I'd like to say that if you're wondering if you're an alcoholic, you know, because everybody gets here differently. You know, some people catch you alcoholism on a bar stool, you pass an invisible line, you know, where everybody's different, you know. And I tell our friend Gail, where she at, that she's the one that's important. I mean, you listen to me talk and go, well, that guy needs to be. But, you know, the people that are alcoholics that just can't figure it out, they're the ones that really need to be, you know, helping others. And at an early age, 16, 17 years old, I'm already in big trouble from drinking. I wrecked cars. We had these things back then called Quaaludes. And I know this is AA, but I mean, man, the government, they outlawed those things for a reason. And I hate to say it, half of my friends from high school are in the cemetery because of Quaaludes. I mean, people drinking alcohol should not ever do those things. I mean, I was in big trouble. Well, they had a lot to do with it. But I was living in Florida, but I had family here, and I went to Ridgeview in Atlanta. And Dr. Talbot had just opened up the adolescent chemical dependency ward of it is what it was called. And I had good insurance, you know how that goes. So in lieu of going to juvenile jail, I went to Ridgeview. And the thing I remember the most about being there is they would march us around the gym to the back, and right there under Dr. Talbot's office on Friday night at 8 o'clock, still meets to this day. We're at same room, same time, everything. They had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they marched us around there. And I remember the first meeting I went to, all these old people, about my age now, they're talking about drinking liquor and breaking bones and breaking vows and wrecking cars and wrecking lives and projectile vomit and all the stuff we do drink. And as they went around, man, woman, child, I mean, everybody that talked, I could relate to what they were saying. I mean, every one of them. Because they were talking about the problem of alcoholism. And I felt like I fit right in. Now, what they talked about, and I remember this, is they talked about that when their drinking became objectionable to them, what they did is they asked for help. They asked another man or another woman or a power greater. And that's where I said, okay, well, I got this. If I ever run into somebody that needs AA, I'll point it out, you know, and show them where to go. Or if it ever gets bad enough, I know where I can go. They did their job carrying the message. They told me about the solution. They carried the message. And that's the book Alcoholics Anonymous on page 30 says that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves we were alcoholic. We learned we had to fully concede. And that's what I had to do. I learned that I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. That's the first step in recovery. And I learned that the hard way. I got to tell you, you know, please don't do what I did. Because, you know, I should have said, well, you know, I'm doing it and didn't. But I didn't. So I left there and I drank, got in big trouble again in the juvenile jail I was trying not to go to. I went straight there anyway. But the seed had been planted, thank God. Because that's what happened. I mean, I was like the Tasmanian devil. Just add alcohol. And I would rip and roar until I got locked down. And every time I got locked down, they'd come in there with this big blue book talking about AA. And, you know, here's what we did. Gotcha. And thank God for that. Because you wore me down. It took 20 years, but you wore me down. Now, my sponsor said I could use a little notes, and I'm not. My first sponsor always said, "You don't use notes. You say the third step prayer, and then you tell your what it was like, and you know, tell your story." But my notes say sponsorship, home group, service. That's all they say. I just want to make sure I don't miss any of that, because that's my only fear about this is that I don't say what you know what God wants me to say. But So I just, the broken record of drinking and carrying on and getting in trouble just went on and on and on and on. And I grew up in South Florida when I left here. And I got to blame it on somebody, right? I'm an alcoholic. You watch the Dukes of Hazzard and Uncle Jesse would just make the moonshine. They'd go tearing down the road with Bo and Luke Duke. And there was, there's Sheriff so-and-so and... And in all those movies, you know, they made movies about. I lived in Miami and moved in the 11th grade. My folks moved us to Noonan, Georgia, and I went from Carl Gables High to Noonan High School, and I had long hair and I was just a troublemaker. And the girls loved me though. It was like I was from Mars or something. They were like, "Ooh, look at that." But no, I'm just kidding. But the city of Noonan was not ready for me, I'll tell you that. And it was back in the day when you could get a DUI and it was $105. And to get a DUI in 1978, you had to do some damage. You know, you had to hit something and tear something up or, you know, you had to really, I mean, that's the only way. And even then, it was $105, and if you paid it before you went to court, it didn't even go on your record. Those days are over. And you know, and I got a lot of DUIs even under those circumstances because it was always bad. And so it just over and over, same thing, over and over. But what happened is the consequences began to get worse. If you drink like that, they got someplace for you. And you know, and that's what happened to me is I, you know, first it started out, I had to admit I stole the beer and get slapped on the wrist. And then it was Ridgeview. And then it was, you know, the nice places started going downhill fast. You know, and from city jail to county jail, from county jail to the work camp. From the work camp, I was talking to a nice couple from Jackson, Georgia earlier, and they said they were from Jackson, Georgia. I said, I used to live there. And they said, really, where? And I said, Georgia City. But that's what happened. I mean, all those movies about what they do in from Miami, we had this bright idea that what we'll do is the same thing they were doing. They're like Uncle Jesse, kind of, you know, and we'll take that stuff from Miami back up there to Georgia, and everybody will like it. And, you know, well, everybody liked it but the sheriff, you know, and I started getting in big trouble. And I was telling my sister-in-law, it's tough, you know, because I'm embarrassed about this now. You know, my family, and you know, some of them are very, very nice people and pillars of the community. But I was, you know, because I look back, it was because of my alcoholism, really. I started drinking, and I was so self-centered and so self-seeking and so lazy and all those character defects. I wish I had a dollar for every time I heard, you think the world revolves around you. And there's no nice way to say I became a drug dealer. You know what I mean? But it was about, you don't have to work real hard. You can drink a lot, and you get, you know, and that's, I'm ashamed of it now. But that's what I got in trouble for. I mean, I was at Georgia State Prison down here, and a counselor said, you have become institutionalized. And I was thinking, what? And she said, I said, no, ma'am, I don't think I have. She goes, well, let's just look at the record. Like AA, right? She goes, in April, you got out of here. In October, you were back again. And then we let you go in June of the next. And I thought to myself, man, I'm not institutionalized. I knew a few people that were, but I was not. I just couldn't. And then back then at Georgia State Prison, on Saturday you could either go out on the yard or go to the cafeteria and watch this movie. They would push this movie projector in, and I went to the movie that week, and they showed The Shawshank Redemption, and it hit me. I guess I'm institutionalized. You know, and I'm an alcoholic, so I had to throw in, I'm probably a psychopath, and criminally insane, and, you know, sociopath, whatever. But it wasn't until later that what became my first sponsor talked about going in and out of correctional institutions. And then he quit drinking and never went back. You know, as I look back, I never went to jail. I never went to prison. I never went to the work camp when it didn't have something to do with drinking. That's just my the way it is. And so when you're younger, you know, you get in trouble. They send you down there for a few months, and then I got in big trouble from a drug trafficking charge. I'd say, oh, I got a traffic ticket, and they sent me. No, it was a drug trafficking charge, and they gave me 10 years. And they were sick of me. They wanted to give me 30 years. That was a big deal back then. And my attorney said, look, the judge is out of town. We're going to get you 10 years today. And I said, great. And I look back, that's a big, but it's better than 30, I guess. But I ended up, when I went down there to Georgia State Prison, I think I'm the only person in the state of Georgia that ever asked to be sent to this prison. Yeah, just so you know, you have a really bad prison around here. That's the one Nelson goes out to. It's called Central CI. And my daddy came to visit me, and he said, listen, your grandmother lives in Macon. Your aunts live there. This prison down there, Mercer University, comes out there to the prison and does classes. I know somebody that can get you sent down there. You know, I know somebody that knows somebody. I said, yeah, that sounds good. So I go back to the cell block, and I tell the cellmates, my dad's going to pull some strings and get me sent to Central CI in Macon, Georgia. And they said, what? That place is that's horrible. That's a disciplinary camp where they send violent criminals, sex offenders. Oh, it's just horrible. Dear Dad, I was writing him a letter because you can't call out or anything. And I'm sure before the letter got to him, I'm being bused to Central CI. And I was scared to death. Had a reputation. And I got there, and Nelson even remembers this guy. He was on the United States bobsledding team. And he was in prison. He was called the Goon Squad. That's if you got in big trouble and you were doing something wrong, they'd come over and take care of you. And he was standing in the door. This guy was huge. And I came walking in there and I said, "Hey, let me ask you something." He said, "Yeah, what is it?" I said, "Is this place as bad as they say it is?" He said, "No, it's probably worse." I was like, "Whoa." And I said, "Well, can I transfer out of here?" And he said, "Yes, you can, after you've been here 2 years." And it was 2 years to the day that I was getting on the bus, leaving out of there. And I got to tell you, it was everything they said it was. But in a setting like that, you learn how to treat people the way you want to be treated. I just kept my mouth shut. I did what I had to do. And after I've been there a while, this guy says, "Do you know why nobody messes with you?" I said, "Huh?" He said, "Nobody messes with you. Do you know why?" I said, "No, why?" He said, "They think you're that crazy guy that killed all those women up in Rome, Georgia, and put them under their bed." And I was like, "What?" He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Well, good. Let them keep thinking that, man." Because all I want to do is just get out of there, you know. But what I did is I got out of there, and then where do you go when you're 30 years old, you know, and you got everything you own in a paper bag? One more time, home to mama. And my mother and father had moved to the panhandle of Florida, to Niceville, Florida, right across the bay from Destin. And we would go down there on vacation. And I remember that big green knight in Destin with a big sword holding at the liquor store over there. And all I could think of was, yes, I'm leaving this penitentiary, going to Destin, Florida. This is going to be great. And I got there, and the parole officer said, "Listen, if you go out and drink one beer and get in trouble, we have a problem." I was like, "Oh, really?" He goes, "But if you go out and drink a half gallon of vodka and don't get in any trouble, it's okay." You know what I heard. And so I wasn't out 3 weeks, and I was already locked back up, just drunk. And deputy said I was going across that Mid Bay Bridge, scraping one side of the wall, going over and scraping, blind drunk. I woke up in jail, you know, and what I did then, you would think, I mean, my God, you stop it, you know, but what I did is I just started the merry-go-round of doo 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 boop, you know, like the broken record, doo 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 boop, in Florida, just like I had in Georgia. You know, the record would play, and doo doo doo, and then it would skip, boop, and I'd get locked down, like I said, a pretty good old boy sober, so I'd tell them what they want to hear, and then they'd turn, and I'd start drinking. That's crazy, but that's what I got, and I have to remember that. But what happened for me is, in Bill's story on page 7, he says that at the end, the doctor came with a heavy sedative, and the next day found him drinking both gin and sedative, and that combination soon landed him on the rocks. And that's exactly what happened for me. And, you know, I had done all this nonsense here and drinking and everything. But I got there, and she wasn't a doctor, but she played one on TV. No, I'm just kidding. She came with a heavy sedative, and it soon found me on the rock. I mean, the mixture of things that I was doing, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and my singleness of purpose is, I used to say I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, because that's cool, you know. But now I know that I am an alcoholic. And I did drugs alcoholically. And if one is good, give me 21. You know, and that's just for me. That's what I believe. And I can still do that today. I have to be careful. I can do anything alcoholically. You know, I'm not drinking, but I can drink coffee alcoholically. You know, 11 o'clock at night, the meeting's been over 2.5 hours. My Ben rode up here, and he gave me some great advice. Don't drink any coffee. And I said, really? He said, yeah, the last time you drank a bunch of coffee, you turned purple in the face, and you were just wide open. And you even looked at me and said, man, I got to quit drinking coffee. And so I could do anything alcoholically. And so that took me to my knees fast, you know. And what happened is I kept going in and out of this detox at the Panhandle of Florida in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And you could go in for free. They just take you. Come on in. And I drink and just rip and roar until I just come up for air and go into detox. And they'd take me in, and it got to be a pattern. And you know, here it's not as much bad as Florida, but there are a lot of homeless people that live in Florida, I guess, because of the weather or whatever. But I thought, my God, it's almost like I became resigned to the fact that that's how I'm going to die, is drink and drink and drink and drink and then run and get the detox. But every time I came to that detox, here they come with this big blue book again talking about, this is what we did. When it became objectionable to us, we asked for help. Got it. And one of the big things that kept me from Alcoholics Anonymous was that I thought if I ever got here, that it would be like joining the Legion of the Damned. That life as I knew it would be over. It'd be the worst thing I could ever imagine, a life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Dear God, just kill me now, you know. I mean, I remember sitting in that detox telling the other patients or clients or inmates, whatever they are, I said, listen, I'll die drunk in a ditch before you see me at AA talking about my dog died, my girlfriend left me, but I called my sponsor and worked this, you know, just come on, that's ridiculous. That'll never happen. I'll die drunk in a ditch before that happens. And that's what I thought, you know, because my mind told me that. My mind told me all about sobriety. And it was not good. And so I fought this thing with everything I had in me. Until I finally, I can't even take credit for it. I was just tired. And the Allman Brothers didn't hurt either. My buddy called me and said, the Allman Brothers are playing 3 nights at the Fox Theater, and we have a room across the Peachtree Street at the Georgian Terrace. Come on. And I left down there and came up for 3 nights with the Allman Brothers band. And the guy came up to me in mid-set on the second night and said, you have to leave, sir. And I said, well, what have I done? He said, you just have to leave. I said, but what have I done? He said, well, you really haven't done anything. And I looked across the way, and there was my buddy who I went with. And he was standing over there looking. And I went, it dawned on me, I look like him. That's why I'm being asked to leave. It's okay. And I left. But it took me down a few notches. And I was tired. I mean, I ripped it. My mother used to say, another lost weekend, huh? It was a lost 2 weeks. And, you know, I got back to Florida somehow. I don't know how. I had a 67 Volkswagen Beetle with no floorboards. And how I got back to the Panhandle of Florida, I'll never know. And I went by my brother's house, and he said, and like 6:30 in the morning, and I wasn't up early. He was. He had a cup of coffee in his hand and a paper under his arm and a robe and one of those old walk-around phones with the antenna you pull out. And I pulled up, and he said, when I heard that little raggedy bug coming around the corner, no, he said, I'm going to do you a favor. I said, what's that? And he said, when I heard that little... He said, I'm going to give you a piece of advice. When I heard that little bug come around the corner, I called the sheriff's department. Because you're an alcoholic and a loser. And I don't want you around my children. And he turned around and walked in the house. I was like, damn. And he informed me, the sheriff was looking for me too, which that was nothing new. And I knew I had warrants again. You know, they say you have to be at rock bottom. Well, an old catfish out here in the Oak Bog, he lives on the bottom, you know. And I had lived on the bottom for a while. And it became a way of life. But I I began to think of a way out because I couldn't keep going on the way I was going. And I got to tell you what I began to think of. I couldn't go to AA. I already told you what that'd be like. And I couldn't keep going the way I was going. So my solution was, I'll just kill myself because I can't take this anymore. I want out, and I just can't take it anymore. And every time I thought of a new way to kill myself in this 72-hour period right before I got sober, I remember I had a gun, and I'm writing a note, and I'm under the Destin Bridge, and the thought came, you can always go back to AA. And I just wrote faster. I mean, because I could not, I mean, I just know, I just could not think of that as a solution. But no, I can't take credit for it. All I can take credit for is drinking enough and ripping and roaring enough and breaking enough hearts and letting everybody down one more time. I got a bottle of Jim Beam and some other stuff, and I had all intentions of drinking that liquor and doing what I was going to do. And I went by this, my mother told me to get out of there in no uncertain terms. I stopped by her house to see Mom, you know how that goes. But this girlfriend of mine, she had dumped me and kicked me to the curb, but her mother was always very nice to me. And I went over and I said, it was 10 o'clock at night, and I knocked on the door, and she opened it, but it had a little chain on it, you know. She said, what do you want? And I said, Marilyn, I'm going to get some help tomorrow or turn myself in or whatever. And I said, but can I spend the night here, you know? And she said, there's an old army cot out there in the garage. You can sleep on that. But I want you gone before the kids get up and get on the bus in the morning. And she slammed the door in my face. And I'm like, cool. Because that's all I wanted, somewhere to drink that liquor. And I went out into her little half bathroom there, and her boys would work on trucks and get grease all over it and pee all over the commode. It was gross. It was perfect for what I wanted. And I never will forget, I sat down on that commode, had all intentions of drinking that bottle of Jim Beam, but something came over me. I was just tired, bone-weary tired, and I got down on my knees. First I poured the bottle of Jim Beam, that's a spiritual experience right there, poured the bottle of Jim Beam in the commode and got down on my knees and said, God, help me. I cannot go on like this. I flushed the commode and I fell over on the old army cot, and I truly believe that my alcoholic mind died that night in Seminole, Florida, November 18th, 1998. I didn't know it then, but I know it now, because what happened is the next morning, early in the next morning, I should have slept for 3 days, but early the next morning I got up, or I came to, or reborn, whatever you might call it. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't think about going. That's my big thing, is my thing was, you know, if I was drinking and ripping and roaring, I had my mind going 1,000 miles an hour like a rat in a cage, and it never would stop. And it never was nice. It was that crazy ego, and it was always dark, and it was always crazy. It was never, let's go down and volunteer. It was like, let's go rob. You know, it was bad. But it had stopped. And I drove down to 52 Beale. I parked around back because I knew I had warrants and I didn't want Fort Walton's finest seeing me. And I walked to the door, the slide glass door, and I opened it up. And there was a guy who was in detox with David. I was in detox with him 5 times probably. And David had been the custodian for a couple of months at the clubhouse. And he was mopping the floor, and he'd been sober about 2 months, so he could preach at me, you know. And he said, when are you going to quit fighting this thing? And I don't know what I told David, but he said, why don't you come in here and let us help you? And that's what I did. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I let you help me. And my life changed. To this day, it's just gotten better and better every day, and it's just been the best thing that's ever happened to me. We're pretty sharp people. And you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's 1 hour of them telling you what to do. Do this, don't do that, come over here, go over there, don't go do it. And that's what I began. I began to listen. I began to listen to the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to do what they say to do. And I knew where my sobriety uncle, Bob Olson from out in Colorado, says, the people that are doing the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous are hanging around the people that are doing the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. The people that are shucking and jiving are hanging around with the people that are shucking and jiving. Who are you hanging around with? So I knew where those people were. They were at a Catholic church on Tuesday night. I couldn't stand that meeting. They did not allow for burning desires. And, you know, they didn't, and I'd like to give a burning, you know, they would cut me off. And they were the high binders. I'd been over to that meeting a couple of times. I remember one time I pulled up and I was in my raggedy little car and I heard them on the porch laughing. And the way they were laughing, you know, that deep laugh, I couldn't get from the car to the porch. So I got in my car and went to the whiskey barn and got drunk to spite them, because I just couldn't get out of the car to the porch. But that's where I went. You know, the fanatics, those high binders over there at the Miracle Group in Fort Walton Beach. They thought they knew it all, you know. Work to get a sponsor, do the steps, and get involved in service. But that's where I went when I was dying. And there was a man that was down there at the detox over and over and over again. I was in detox one time, and he came in there and shared his story. And he had a 10-year sentence, and he was paroled and got out and picked up a drink and went back. Got paroled again, went back, did that 3 times, took his time to the door, and I was on my 3rd parole violation when I heard him say that. I couldn't dodge or duck the fact that he had a solution. That's the man I went to. And I got to tell you, another thing that helped me choose him was I was in the county jail prior to that. And I was talking to my cellmate, a guy named Donnie. And I ripped and roared with Donnie. And I said, you know, Donnie, when I get out of here and get serious with AA, I'm going to ask this guy, Mark B. from Navarre, Florida, to sponsor me. And Donnie said, dude, don't do it. That guy's nuts. He was sponsoring me, and I got drunk, and he came over and just beat the hell out of me. That guy's just not right upstairs. I mean, he's like that. But as he spoke, I thought to myself, man, maybe I can stay sober if the guy will come over and beat me up. And that was my thought. And I learned later that there was a little more to it. Donnie was all whacked out on crack and drunk. And my sponsor and his wife came over to take him to a meeting, and he swung at my sponsor's wife. Then he beat him up. So, I mean, it was a... But that's who I asked. I went to, and I asked Mark to help me. I said, he was walking out, and he was a big guy. He was a Vietnam vet, and he was a... Saved my life. But I cut him off walking out, and I said, hey man, can I talk to you for a minute? He said, what's up? Because he'd seen me in and you know, I'd been around AA for a long time. Whew. And I said, I need some help, man. I need a sponsor. Can you help me? And he qualified me for Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew I was an ANDA. You know, he'd see me pull up in the Volkswagen van with smoke rolling out of it, you know, and I come in and he'd go, hey, look at your eyes. What you been smoking? I mean, hey, leave me alone. You know, I feel uncomfortable. But he qualified me for AA. He said, let me ask you something. Are you alcoholic? And I said, oh, yeah, man. I mean, I got double-digit DUIs. I've more problems with alcohol than most people. He said, listen. First of all, I want to tell you that I can't get you drunk. I can't get you sober. This is between you and God. This is an inside job. He said, but I'm going to tell you something. If you are willing to do whatever's asked of you on a daily basis, you and I can stay sober one day at a time together. I said, man, just tell me what to do, man. I said, I'm dying. He said, I want you to get up in the morning, get down on your knees, and ask God to keep you away from a drink just for that day. And he said, beg God to keep you away from a drink and help you to do whatever it takes to stay sober for that day. And if you don't believe in God, I don't really care. You just do it. And I was started to tell him, well, I don't really have every, and he just interrupted me because he did not care. He said, did you drink every day? I said, well, yeah. He said, I want you in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day till I tell you otherwise. You get to the bar, you can get to a meeting, period. And I was in a city where they had 150 meetings a week, so I could get to a meeting. He said, the third thing is do not drink. And what I mean by that is if you start obsessing about a drink or taking some pills or doing some whatever it is you do, you pray. You get down on your knees and pray. Ask God to remove that obsession. You go in a port-a-john on the job. Go in a closet. You just do it in front of people, but you pray. And he said, the fourth thing is, and I don't get all my guys to do this, he said, but I've heard you share in meetings. I want you to call me every day between 5 and 6 o'clock. He says, and I want you to be quiet until you've done your fifth step. I don't want you sharing in any more meetings. I don't want you spreading your illness anymore until you've done your fifth step. I didn't much like that, but I didn't say anything. And he said, the fifth thing is, if you've stayed sober for that day, you thank God that night. And I said, okay. He said, you call me tomorrow at 5 o'clock. And he just walked off and handed me his number. And that's how I began. You know, and then I got out on the porch and he said, hey, wait a minute before you go. Do you have a driver's license? I said, no. Didn't you just pull up in that raggedy little bug over there before the... And I said, yeah, but I only drive that to meetings. And he said, no. If you want me to sponsor you, don't drive. I was like, what? What is that? I mean, I didn't say that. He's a big old guy, but he might beat me up. Right? But I got somebody to drive the little bug, you know. And I was staying in this little motel thing right down by the clubhouse. I was going to go to the clubhouse the next morning. I got in the little Beetle, and I'm brum, 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 warming it up. And it hit me in my head. Don't drive! Oh, man! Don't drive. But what I did is I got out and I started walking to the meeting. You know, and the whole way I'm walking, I'm thinking, this is stupid. Don't drive. Do this. Don't do that. Go over here. Go over. Don't blah, 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 blah. Pray and blah, 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 blah. But I was putting one foot in front of the other, in front of the other, in front of the other for the first time in my life. You know, and I used to say, I do what I want to do when I want to do it. That's what I, you know, drinking. And my NCIC, that's the National Crime Information Service, it proves that, you know. My chart at the hospital proves I do what I want to do. And there's an old guy at the clubhouse, Vern, that ran the clubhouse. He goes, who wants some sponsor telling them what to do and when to do it and how to live? And I said, Vern, since that man started telling me what to do and when to do it, I hadn't been back to jail. I hadn't been back to the emergency room. I hadn't been back... And Vern knew me. He said, yeah, I guess you're right. I guess you got a point. And that's just me now. I mean, I had to be told stuff like, you're on parole and probation and have a thing on your ankle blinking and you're driving with no license? What are you, retarded? You know? I'd be like, I didn't think about all that. But, you know, I mean, that's... Today I realize that's real. But... my life began to change from that point. And I had, like I said, I had warrants. He said, I want you to, we got to the point, and he started working me through the steps. We did the third step prayer, and he says, okay, you're going to turn yourself in. You'll have plenty of time to do your inventory at the county jail. He was right. And that's what I did. I did my fourth step at the county jail. And my first promise, that's on my list here, talking about the promises, was I had 6 years to do. I had 3 years to go in Georgia on an interstate warrant. And then when I got out of there, I had to go back to Florida for a 2-year suspended sentence. And then I had this little pot charge I had. It was another year. My parole officer used to come, he came down to the jail and asked me, what's going to be different this time if I go to bat for you? And I told him the truth. I said, I can't promise you anything. I tell you what I'll probably do is I'll probably let you down. I said, you'll go to bat for me and then I'll get out and get dry. I said, but I'll tell you one thing. Today, I am not going to take a drink. Just for today. And he later on, he told me when he was coming to our home group asking for help. Isn't that so? He said, you told me the truth that day. And so I went to bat for you. And I was getting shackled and the car was in the breezeway from Coweta County to take me back to Georgia. And a guy came in the room and said, we just got this from the teletype. Florida's going to keep him on supervision. And so I'm like, well, what does that mean? I was getting in the sheriff car to go back to Georgia, to prison. And they said, well, you can go. And they started taking the shackles off of me and said, you just report to Shalimar in the morning. I don't know. Nelson probably knows. Is that a spiritual experience? Walking down that hall, and I hit the ground running. I haven't looked back yet. I've been like a rutting buck. Because I know if I let up for 2 seconds, you know, I'll drink again. But if I don't, I'm going to be okay. And you know, Dr. Bob says, if we go at this like half the zeal as we took to getting another drink, we'll be okay. You know, I wanted to talk about what I do today. Because what I do today and what I do when I got sobered up is very important. When I got sobered up, my sponsor told me, weren't you in that detox over and over and over again? And I know I'm getting close on time. And I said, yes. He said, Waddell goes in on Saturday night and takes an AA meeting in there. Why don't you ask him if you can go with him? And I've been going to detox every week ever since. Period. Every week I go to a detox and tell my story. And I don't know if it helps them, but it sure helps me. And I got involved in corrections. He says, I want you to come to the corrections meeting. I said, no. I'm still on parole, man. I can't do all that. And he said, no. Just come to the meeting. They elected me the secretary of the corrections committee. I'm like, man, they hoodwinked me every time. I've been involved in corrections. That's how I met Nelson. We were walking down the hall, and I said, I moved here to Georgia. Come right to Area Assembly. I mean, I would not ever think not to come to Area Assembly. That's what God does for me. And I don't know if you know, it's a gift. It's called willingness. And I just pray for it and I get it because my sponsor's first wife was Cherokee, and in their culture they believe if somebody saves your life, you owe them your life. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. You know, so I can't do enough for it. My great grand sponsor, I come from a sponsor lineage that my sponsor, Mark B., was sponsored by Don P. out of Aurora, Colorado. And Tom I. was his, you know. And those guys, you know, I remember Tom I. talking about, I'm the busiest man in Alcoholics Anonymous that I know. And I was like, I like the sound of that, you know. I want to be the busiest guy in AA that I know, you know. And with mentors like that, you know, it's a pretty good deal. And so, when I first got sober, I was going to Monday night, I was going to the prison. Monday night, I go to the juvenile prison. I got in there. Tuesday night, I go to my home group. Wednesday, I go to detox. Thursday, I go to the Friary, which was another treatment center. You know what I mean? And to this day, I do just like I did when I got sobered up. I moved up here to Georgia, back to Georgia. I go to a step study every week. I go to a big book study every week. I do something in corrections every week. Right now, we're kind of in hiatus with. I go to a detox every week. And I go to my home group, and I'm active in that every week. You know? And it works for me. You know, I don't know if you're struggling in AA, but do those things. And you know, in Bill's story, it says, here, I'll read it because I can. It says, what has been my saving grace? And I want to tell you about my daddy. My friend emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. And here it is. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Service and Alcoholics Anonymous has been my saving grace. All kind of things have happened to me while I'm carrying the message. You know, my mother got sick and passed away. My father got sick and passed away. And I had done the amends. I had gone, well, I'm sorry. You know what we do. And I was wrong. And I stole for, you know, and all that. But I really made amends when I gave my mother a bath. And I put socks on her feet. And I fed her. And was there for her till she took her last breath. That's making amends. You know? And my daddy, when he was dying, this man did everything he could for me and could not save me from alcoholism. And he had this love-hate relationship with AA. He loved it, but at some point he's like, he's a little jealous, you know. But he loved AA, and he especially loved the eating meetings. But he can I get up there and talk? And I'm like, no, yeah. But he was dying. You know, I mean, my father was a hero, man. He was a hero. He was awarded the Bronze Star in World War II. And in World War II, he crashed two planes and ditched two planes and, you know, lived to tell about it. But he was dying, and he had an accident, and I cleaned him up and put him in the bathtub and cleaned him and cleaned up the bathroom and had him out there. And then he had another accident, took him back in there and gave him another bath. And he was worn out. I was worn out. And I was putting socks on his feet. His hair was off. And he looked down at me and he said, I'm sorry, I'm such a pain in the ass. I looked up at him and I said, if I take care of you this way for the next 100 years, I'll never balance the books. And when I got done, I went outside, got down beside my Jeep, and I got down on my knees, and I thank God. I thank God for the ability to be there for my father and my mother and for Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's Alcoholics Anonymous that's changed my life and taken me to a better place and just totally transformed everything. And my buddy Ben, you know, I'm kind of one of those sick people that attract sick, and the worst of, hey Ben. I want to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. Ben says, I'm going to make amends to my ex-wife. And he had ripped and roared, and it's just, she had given him every opportunity, and just finally she said, I can't take it. And her and her daughter, you know, they loved him dearly. They had to move on. So he was going to make amends to his ex-wife. But that day, her new husband came instead of her. And he prayed about it. And he went up there and he told the man that was the new father for his little girl that he was wrong and he owed him an amends and wanted to know what he could do to make it right. Whew, that's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. What a wonderful thing it is to be a part of that, you know. I mean, it's just so far from all that, what I thought I was looking for. This is it, you know. And I just want to thank each and every one of y'all. I mean, I could talk and talk and talk and talk and talk about all the wonderful gifts. Let me see on my notes if I missed anything. I don't think I have, but I thanked everybody. But my home group is so important. You know, it's always been a big part. And sponsorship, you know. Get to know your sponsor. That's what Bill says. Don't be so anonymous that your sponsor forgets who you are. You know, I talked to my sponsor before I came up here. I've got I got to tell you my relationship with God in 1 minute or less. Y'all ever see the movie Bruce Almighty? Where God just loves Bruce, yeah, it's Jim Carrey. And he just is a spoiled brat that never has enough. And he's a news guy, but he wants to be the news anchor. And he's got Jennifer Aniston at home, for God's sakes. But that's everything. He's just more. Kind of like me, you know. And in spite of himself, God takes him and puts him over here, you know. And that's me, man. I'm just selfish. And God has taken me and put me over here and in spite of me. And it's just been the absolute best thing that's ever happened to me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love all of y'all. And thank you for allowing me to be a part of your sobriety this week.